Oasis Podcast, Episode 10, Dr. Ken Womack. Hello and welcome to the Oasis podcast. This is episode 10. We've reached double figures in just over a month, so that's pretty good. You can't argue with that. Thank you everybody for engaging on Twitter, and thank you for everyone who's got in touch. It really feels like this is kicking off with some pace now, which is really, really good. I didn't really expect this to go so well, so yeah, taking up quite a bit more time than I expected, but hey, it's all good, it's all great. And thank you so much for everyone who's got in touch on Twitter, whether it's just through private messages or through direct tweets at me or emails. You know, it's been really busy. We have got a great conversation coming up, which is with a renowned, world-renowned, established Beatles author and scholar, Ken Womack. He starts talking to me about Virginia Woolf and people like that, who I don't really know very much about. So yeah, he's far cleverer than I am, but there you go, most people are. We have a really good and interesting conversation. We talk about a lot about the Beatles, a lot about Oasis, as you'd expect. And you might hear a brief interruption in the middle of the podcast. That's when his deluxe six disc edition set of Sgt. Pepper's reissue arrives, which is which was made me extremely jealous, because it's not actually out, and I think until a couple of weeks time. So yeah, so he got hold of that, and then for the rest of the conversation you can kind of see him longingly looking away at this six disc set and not really paying attention to the podcast. No, seriously, he was a good guy. So just a couple of other bits. First thing, competition time. The good people at Supernova Scarves, a wonderful person called Belinda, has reached out and is happy to give out a scarf of your choice to a competition winner. So what if you want to get a fantastic Supernova scarf, and they do like wonderful, cool, like paisley, cravat, mod style scarfs. They're great. Check them out at Supernova_scarves on Twitter, and just Google Supernova scarves, you'll find them. Exactly the sort of thing that mods wear. Liam often sports that sort of style. So the question is, who is the best dressed man in rock and roll? Who is the best dressed person in music, and why? So if you can tweet at me at Oasis Podcast, give me who is the best dressed man in music and why, and the best answer will win the prize, win the scarf. And it's the scarf of your choice from the Supernova Scarves website. So get in touch with me on that one. And obviously follow me, follow Supernova Scarves as well. And yeah, and tell them, make sure you're tweeting them, including them in the tweet, and maybe we'll be able to do some more giveaways. And if you, yeah, go and check out Supernova Scarves. They've got absolutely gorgeous stuff, so get involved. So we're going to move on to Ken Womack now. Just to let you know that at the end of the interview, it kind of ends very abruptly. There was some sort of sound problem at his end, so it ends pretty abruptly. So enjoy this interview with Ken Womack while it lasts, and then I'll probably jump in at the end and just finish it off and say goodnight. So after this brief musical interlude, it's on to my conversation with world-renowned Beatles scholar and all-round good bloke, Dr. Ken Womack.
Shut up.
Shut up.
Here I stand with head in hand. I turn my face to the wall. If she's gone, I can't go on. Feeling 2 foot small.
Ken, how are you doing?
Doing great. So glad to be with you on the Oasis podcast.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Now, you're a doctor. I've got some sort of itching sensations going on in various parts of my body. What sort of medication would you recommend for that?
Well, being that I am a professor of 20th century British literature, I would recommend maybe some Virginia Woolf. I think you should. I think you should read
apply
to the
liberally light. Twice a day.
That's right. Apply very liberally, and Virginia Woolf will make you better.
Wonderful, great. I'll try that. I'll try that later. I'm just trying to think. Can I? I can't even pull a Virginia Woolf reference to hit you with. But if I could tie in a Virginia Woolf reference, no, don't know. I don't know enough about literature, obviously. So thank you so much for your time today. I do really appreciate it. As I say, I've been aware of your stuff from your writing, and then also you sort of being on another podcast I listen to, just as primarily as an expert and scholar on the Beatles. So I just wanted to get an idea for sort of your background, because I know you, I've heard you talk about the Beatles a lot. I've never really heard you talk about you and how you got into music. So what was it the Beatles, or was it someone else growing up that really got you turned onto music?
It really was the Beatles. I like a lot of kids, I grew up in the 70s, the late 70s, early 80s. And I would listen to your top 40 radio, perhaps. But I have a Beatles discovery story. They eclipsed my favorite television show in the late 1970s. I was watching the New Zoo Review, and there they were in the Beatles cartoons, which, of course, are lame and awful. I mean, they're charming in their own way, but as we know, it's not the coolest way to find your way into the Beatles. I'm not a first-generation fan by any stretch, so I don't have memories of the Ed Sullivan Show or even of them breaking up. I simply had no idea who they were. And so they were my entree. I was a musician at the time. I played guitar. I was in orchestra at school. And I'd always been fascinated by the language of music as a way to communicate different aspects of the human condition. Up to that point, it was really instrumental music that did that for me. But the Beatles, not surprisingly, as with me, as with perhaps billions of others, right? They opened up new vistas of imagination. And from there, I was really cooking, in a lot of ways, and still am. I mean, I'm endlessly fascinated by them because of the improbability of their story, but also the simple act of creation, how they went from the band that was making pretty primitive music like Love Me Do to the White Album and Abbey Road. That is an incredible leap in a very short amount of time. Virginia Woolf doesn't do that, quite frankly, and neither does James Joyce or Picasso, right? Most artists require a full lifetime to accomplish something like that. And even then, they probably haven't met their goals. In many ways, the Beatles broke up having met their goals, their objectives as a band.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think it's... That is just the crazy thing for me. I mean, when you see that the red and the blue album covers, you know, in the same shot when they're looking down the stairwell, and you see them at, and you think that is 7 years, that's 62 to 69, and the world had changed, you know, everything, they had changed significantly, but the world had changed so much.
Yeah, and the photographs are even better because they're 6 years apart.
Oh goodness, okay.
Right, so it's now tell me, while I think your listeners maybe already know, but I'd like to know, what was your Oasis discovery story?
Well, Oasis discovery, I did sort of tell this briefly on the first episode, but yeah, basically it was I was a massive fan of loads of different types of music growing up, and Oasis for me was there was quite a few kind of indie bands with that same haircut in that early 90s. So, you know, you've got people like the Charlatans and the Stone Roses, and there's all these different bands, a lot of them from Manchester, who had that kind of that Beatles haircut and that kind of swagger and that sound. And it wasn't my thing, really. I mean, I was into quite a lot of different music in the early 90s, whether it be kind of Nirvana and Metallica and the sort of American heavier stuff, or then sort of dance music, people like The Prodigy and things like that in the UK. But then Oasis sort of gradually over this period throughout 1994, as they just got bigger and bigger and were more and more exciting, more and more interesting. And yeah, and it just became, and you know, and that was for me as a teenager as well. So sort of getting into them at kind of 14, 15 years old. And I sort of talked about it as like my punk year zero, you know, as when you think, right, this is me now. I'm changing my clothes, I'm changing my haircut, I'm signing up to this. This is my new way of life. And yeah, and so I absolutely did that. And then sort of 20 years later, I'm still banging on about them. But yeah, I mean, was it your teenage? I mean, so you were a bit late for them as a going concern. I mean, was there a band that was your kind of when you were sort of 14, 15 that was,
well,
that,
that's,
you know, really got insane?
You know, I don't think it occurred to me until just now, but I think that they were my band. And so I'm 12 years old in 1978, right? People aren't listening to the Beatles the way they are now.
No.
If there ever were a period, and they're arguably hasn't been, but if there were ever a period where maybe their star was slightly down, it probably was those years before John's assassination, and then perhaps a bit in the early 80s during the MTV era when it really took hold. There was a slight period when perhaps they weren't enjoying the kind of sensational place that they were before then, and really in many ways ever since that period. You know, because by the time they get to the 90s, you know, they're outselling everybody again. So the 80s were almost their was a very strange epoch for them. If ever they were slightly down, that was when it was. You know, and you look at now the hysteria around the new Sgt. Pepper remixes. It's incredible. They are truly a going concern now. But I think I might have found the Beatles in that moment when they were slightly less in the public eye. Wings was coming to a close. John wasn't recording in those years. George had sort of seen the best of his days for a while. He came back again, of course, at the end of the 80s in a big way. Ringo has certainly had seen his heyday pass. So it was for a while there among my peer group, the Beatles were my band. They weren't anybody else's band. Nobody else was really loving them. I mean, I'd run into another kid every now and then who enjoyed them. But it wasn't the same as you might it might be now. And certainly not as it would have been in the early 70s or just at about any other time since. So it was a unique place where they kind of were mine. in fact, there were moments when I even thought, this is almost a nostalgia thing, right? Because my parents would say things like, well, yeah, we haven't really thought about them much. So it was a very strange little interregnum there in the post-Beatles life of the Beatles, if you will.
Well, I definitely remember that from I'm born 1980, and I remember that in the growing up, even in the sort of into the early 90s before Anthology came along. And I think in the UK it was really Anthology that pushed them back into being a cool band again. I mean, I remember going to school with a kid who was a big Beatles fan, and we would take the mickey out of him. You know, it wasn't cool. It wasn't cool to be into the Beatles. And I remember now, I sort of cringe about it now. But yeah, but it was anthology, and it was then getting into music in that Britpop period where all these bands were sort of talking about the Beatles, and then you sort of think, oh, okay, we need to look at this again. But I think I mentioned it on the previous episode, but I remember listening to, because Oasis covered I'm the Walrus live as one of their early, you know, and one of their early B-sides, and it's a phenomenal, you know, version. But so I was thought, okay, I need to go and dig back into the Beatles. I need to listen to this I'm the Walrus song that I'd never heard before. The first version I'd heard was the Oasis version. And I remember listening to it and just thinking, what is this? It just didn't make sense to me. You know, coming from having listened to Nirvana and you know, heavier rock, and then into this Britpop and Oasis and that side of it, I'm thinking, what is this? There's these weird noises and strings and just bizarre, and I just couldn't get my head around it, and I just didn't. I thought, no, this isn't right. You know, I need overdriven guitars and gain and the snarl and the sneer of Liam. You know, and so yeah, so it did take me a while to then go back into it, and it was the anthology really that was the big push for that, which I think is late 94, I believe, that came out.
It was 94. You're right, 94, and it was probably the smartest business decision they ever made, because it set the stage for so many more things. And you know, one of the reasons why they are sort of late to the party there, if you recall, they weren't available on compact disc until 1987. Mm-hmm. So they allowed a considerable amount of time to pass before they were in vogue with the latest format change. Right. I mean, that was an incredible amount of period that they had allowed to elapse. And I'm not saying that they put their story at risk, but they certainly did make consumers wait a good long time. Now, when they finally came out with them, of course, they smartly made each album an event as they released each one. And that really has been their game plan ever since. But I would agree with you that the anthology was crucial.
Well, I was just listening to the episode you did with the guys that do the When They Was Fab podcast. And I mean, and they play on there a track by Anthony Robustelli. And I love Anthony Robustelli's work, like the way he goes back in and remixes and pulls out that stuff. I mean, that has just been such an eye-opener for me.
She took me half the way there now. She was a day tripper, one-way ticket, yeah. It took me so long to find out, and I found out. Try to please.
he's enormously talented, Anthony, and he's a great person too, you might be happy to know. Just a wonderful guy with a great family.
But no, he's and it's such an incredible skill, because especially when he's attacking those early ones that are recording on like 2-track, you know, and yet he's able to digitally pull out these things. And that's the frustrating thing, is we know that Apple or whoever it is has got the ability to do this, because obviously they did it with Rock Band, you know, and if people don't know, if people listening don't follow the Beatles quite as closely as we do, the Nintendo Wii game Rock Band actually went in and had these isolated tracks. And so a lot of clever people then suddenly cracked the code of the game and pulled out these isolated tracks and put them out there on YouTube and things like that. And they get taken down occasionally. But so we know that they can do it.
And that's the market.
Why do they not just release every single track? Because the scholars, there's an industry of scholars who are desperate for it.
You're absolutely right. And they're really missing an opportunity there, because that's the future. You know, we have that Beach Boys release, right, where you have all of the different versions of Good Vibrations and various isolated pieces. That is what folks want. And we know this because the survey data, particularly about millennials, although I'm just as interested, is that millennials want to know how things are made. They're very intellectually curious. They like to be active learners. And the isolation mixes are absolutely the direction that not just the Beatles, but everyone should be going. They own the content. Yeah. People are going to do it anyway, as you just said. So why not make it available in a consumer-friendly way?
No, absolutely. I completely agree. But, I mean, one of the things I was going to say about, and I say the my raison d'etre for this podcast really was that, you know, I love the Beatles. I listen to a lot of Beatles podcasts, and particularly, you know, Something About the Beatles. I think, you know, Richard Buskin and Robert Rodriguez.
No, they were just here 2 weeks ago.
I saw the
on the shore.
So I mean, and I really like those guys. Now, what I really like about their podcast is just the antagonism between them. You get the British element, you get the American element.
And that's real, by the way.
Is that real?
Yeah, I mean, they love each other, but there's no doubt that they needle each other. It's actually quite entertaining.
Good, you know, and he's more Lennon and he's more McCartney, and so you just get this great, really great interaction and stuff. But and finally Robert's finally saying Twickenham now, not Twickenham, which he was for the first sort of few episodes. But yeah, it's listening to those guys, you know, and every inch of tape, as I said, every single interaction and has been analysed of the Beatles to the nth degree. And there's so many books, there's so many, you know, people writing about them, and it's, I suppose you've got Dylan as well at that level. And yet you think, well, is it almost a shame that there's other artists out there that aren't getting, you know, if the Beatles are getting 100 out of 100 attention, there's surely there's people out there that are deserving of at least say 60 out of 100, whether it's like a Bowie or a Lou Reed or someone like that, that you know, and the way I was coming at it is with Oasis. I mean, there just isn't, yes, they don't deserve the same level, you know, they weren't as culturally important and with all everything else, but it feels like there's such a concentration just on these few artists, and yet there's whole swathes of the a lot of other artists that just don't get the attention.
Well, I you're absolutely right, of course. That's true in all scholarly circles. So I mentioned Virginia Woolf and James Joyce. Mm-hmm. You know, you can imagine they're getting more attention than, say, Ford Madox Ford, who I'd rather read any day of the week than Woolf or Joyce. He's wonderful. You know, remember, listeners, listen to The Good Soldier. You know, read The Good Soldier. Well, you can listen to it, too. It's a wonderful audio book with Frank Muller. But in any event, you know, that is always the case, right? People create canons and pecking orders. But people better get cracking on those Oasis books, because what we know about the Beatles, to me, is pretty fascinating. Here is a band that did, you know, their work, essentially in the mid-60s, late 60s, and yet we have whole gaps in our knowledge about them. That's pretty stunning, right? We could go to Sylvia Plath, who killed herself in, what, January or February of 62 or 63, in London, in Yeats's house, the great American poet. We know what she did every day. We have her journals. We have her surviving correspondence. And yet here are these guys who are still some of the most photographed people in the history of planet Earth, and yet we have whole gaps in our knowledge about them. Oasis being a relatively more recent phenomenon shouldn't have that problem. And I would argue that scholars better get cracking and start telling those stories while they're around to tell them, particularly since in their case, the Oasis story is one of the key pillars of it is the relationship between Noel and Liam. You know, that schism is one of the driving elements of their story. And we need to do some work understanding that now, so that when they have their great revival, whether they're living or not, and it will happen, their achievement is big enough and significant enough that will happen. Will scholars, will historians be able to adequately tell their story other than, you know, some grainy YouTube videos and interviews where they trash talk each other?
Well, it's nice to hear that you kind of feel that, you know, they are culturally significant to that point where it will, you know, it will come back. I mean, it's never gone away. They are still a concern. They're still, especially with social media now.
Wouldn't you say that they're the central band in the Brit pop, power pop movement?
Yeah. So they were the biggest. Definitely.
Yeah, right. I mean, so in the same way that, you know, Bowie occupies an almost overwhelming place, right, in terms of glam rock. I mean, it's him and then it's a long way down to the next person.
Yeah, you've got like T-Rex after, but the difference with Bowie
it's a long way down.
A long way down, because especially with Bowie as well, is it's not just, you know, Oasis really encapsulated that kind of 94 to 97 period, and then they did carry on until 2009, but it wasn't at the same level of popularity, success, or artistic achievement. Whereas David Bowie was constantly, you know, reinventing himself and constantly at the forefront of doing interesting things that's worthy of study all the way through from, you know, from the late 60s, even up to his death. I mean, Black Star was a phenomenal achievement, you know, and so it's I mean, what you're saying about I think it's often almost like we were saying about the Beatles, in that you had that period, you know, late 70s before John died, and then I'd say in mid 80s, late 80s as well, where they didn't sort of occupy as an important a role, or they weren't held as such high esteem in popular consciousness for that time period. And it's really, I think, because people were too close to it, and that was sort of like the, you know, they were, it was the, that was that thing from a few years ago that's old hat now, and we're doing this now. And you needed that time to sort of get away from it to then be rediscovered again. And I think that's what we're finding with Oasis now.
Oh, sure.
The bands of like, sorry, go on.
No, you're absolutely right. And that's why we have phrases like stand the test of time, right?
Yeah.
You know, the Beatles, I guess, showed that they stood the test of time. But remember, I said the best business decision they made was the anthology. Actually, the best decision they ever made was never, ever getting together again, all four, after August 22nd, 1969. breaking up and leaving the world stage at the height of their powers with Abbey Road was brilliant. Yeah. You know, and they created a sense of mystique that, unfortunately, because one of them is murdered and another one dies young, relatively young, that that mystique took hold and was concretized for all time. You know, I mean, Oasis had the good or bad fortune to keep rolling on a few more years. It's amazing that they made it that long. But, you know, when we talk about cultural significance, I, in preparation for talking to you today, I mean, I listened to some of my favorite tracks. Champagne Supernova is, wow, it's hard to say that there are too many Beatles songs that are better than that. I mean, that is an incredible organic.
Praise indeed.
Well, but it's an incredible organic achievement. I mean, that song is it's organic. I mean, that's the word for it. The guitar sounds, the construction, the melodic hook.
How many special people change? How many lives are living strange? Where were you while we were getting high? Slowly walking down the hall, faster than a cannonball. Where were you while we were getting high? Someday you will find me caught beneath the landslide in a champagne supernova in the sky. Someday you will find me caught beneath the landslide in a champagne supernova, a champagne supernova in the sky. Wake up the dawn and ask her why. Dream a dream, she never dies. Wipe that tear away now from your eye. Slowly walking down the hall, faster than a cannonball. Where were you while we were getting high? Someday you will find me caught beneath the landslide in a champagne sea.
That is a that is a formidable song. You know, Songbird is an incredible piece of songwriting too. I mean, these are not minor classics.
You know, Songbird's a Liam Gallagher.
I do know, yeah.
As well, yeah. That's interesting, and it's like a two chord song as well. That's
it's like a 2 minute song.
It came from one of our other episodes, actually, with another American guy. A guy called Joel Dickman, who's a punk musician, and I'd sent him a we were sort of picking out our favorite, you know, Oasis heavier rocks type songs, and I sent him a playlist of sort of lesser known songs that I felt were kind of in the heavier rocking kind of world, and expected him to pick out, and if I'd sent that to a big Oasis fan, they would have been picking out early B-sides or definitely maybe album tracks that were like held up as, oh, this is the core great work. But he didn't. He picked two Liam songs, one from the 2005 album, one from the 2008 album. And I said, really? I think it's not having the context. And I think about that like with the Beatles as well. I mean, if Ram had you know, the Beatles on the front, would people think it was as good as Abbey Road? You know, maybe they would, because it's there's definitely moments in all their careers that they'll still hit the peak of the Beatles, but it's just it doesn't have the Beatles written on the front.
Sure, and I tend to argue that those moments are generally occurring closest to their disbandment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not surprisingly.
Yeah. Well, it's you know, I think I was sort of so we've been doing these polls. I'm sorry if I filled your Twitter timeline with a lot of
I enjoyed it. But, keep it coming.
Yeah, we've been doing these Twitter polls. So if you're not following me, then please do it at Oasis Podcast, and you know, and follow Ken as well. You're at is it at Kenneth Womack?
Ken. Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you can search him out. He's easy to find.
I am not hard to find.
And yes, we've been doing these fun Twitter polls, and I think the first one I did was sort of who's just the well, I did a what's the best Oasis Beatles cover version, and yeah, and I'm the Walrus came out pretty strongly, but there's so many various bits and pieces they did, and so that was really good because lots of people were getting involved and pulling out different bits of, you know, captured footage that had been done at sound checks and things like that of different covers they'd done, and that was all good fun. But then what I also did was a who's the best songwriter, and we did the top, you know, we did Noel, John, Paul, George, and for a little while Noel was winning until you kind of tweeted out a little bit, and then I think that got your sort of how many thousand Twitter followers you had, a few of them sort of got involved.
Oh yeah, that must have been the Womack army. Yeah, the Womack army came in. Oh, it was interesting that you'd separated Lennon and McCartney, because I don't know that they're separable in a lot of ways. You know, their relationship certainly drove that band, and don't you think the Gallaghers obviously drives Oasis. Even if Oasis is in mothballs, it's driving them.
Yeah, it is. But I think that the difference is obviously that Liam wasn't a songwriter. But
fair enough. Yeah.
You know, he's become a songwriter, you know, in inverted commas, in later years, because he's not a proficient songwriter that you would expect like a Noel or one of the Beatles. But I definitely agree, and one of the points I've made on here a few times is, for me, the core element of what made Oasis great for that period was Noel Gallagher writing the songs that his brother then sang. And what happened in the later albums is they introduced sort of, you know, Gem and Andy Bell and Liam were all bringing songs to the table. And then Noel was doing a lot more lead vocals as well. And so you end up with, I think in the last album in 2008, I think there's three songs or four songs that have that perfect combination of Noel wrote them, Liam, you know, his brother, you know, Liam singing his brother's words. You know, that's what I want to hear. And that's it. If you get away from that formula, it just doesn't work. And so while the relationship is different, because, you know, and I love the image of, you know, the two of them, the Nurk twins, kind of sitting opposite each other, almost like a mirror reflection, because Paul's playing left-handed, and you know, and just coming back line after line. It's such a beautiful image, and it was that driving synergy between them that created this incredible music. So while they didn't have that, because Noel was writing by himself, right, it was still the, you know, the drive of knowing he's writing for his brother to sing, and so he is writing for Liam's voice. And so when Liam first sings, to stay away from the sunshine in cigarettes and alcohol, you then, the word shine comes into the songs so much more. And there's a really good like YouTube mashup I found, a supercut of every shine in Oasis's history. I need some time in the sunshine.
For the rest of the world, I don't see no-
Obviously realised that Liam sings shine better than anyone. It's such a wonderful sound he makes. And so, yeah, the word shine just keeps coming up over and over again.
Well, you know, in that sense, their relationship, while obviously they share this severe, significant adoration for the Beatles, there's just no, it's obvious. And part of what makes them great, by the way, is they have that thing that they share. You know, whether it's the Beatles or their, you know, their background or what have you, it's important to them. But to me, it you know, the way you describe it, and I should have spent more time thinking about this actually, is it's more like Townsend and Daltrey, where Townsend writes the songs and Daltrey is his expositor, right? And and in many ways, you can hear, particularly as the 70s wear on, Pete is getting better and better at writing for Roger to sing. You know, I mean, You Better, You Bet is a song, you know, in what, 1980 or whenever that album came out, Face Dances, it's clear that it was written for Roger to sing, you know, with his kind of guttural approach to rock front manage, if you will. So it's probably more similar to that, except clearly Daltrey and Townsend have been able to get along for many, many years. But of course, the Gallaghers, unlike even Lennon and McCartney, have something even more difficult, and that is not only do they have the creative tension of being in a band, they're brothers. You know, my God,
so
right?
In that way, it's another 60s band. It's more like Ray and Dave Davis of the Kinks.
Sure,
You then have, I mean, it's slightly different, obviously, because, you know, Dave being lead guitar and then Ray being the songwriter. So it's slightly different there. But, you know, once again, they've fallen out many times over the years. You know, and so it is just that brother thing, isn't it? It's always a problem.
But, sure. And you know, a lot of these folks, particularly like a Lennon and McCartney with that level of success, are in these sardine cans of of experience. And so that it's inescapable. You know, everything that happens is magnified.
Yes, yeah. Well, as I say, you know, the Beatles had the ability to kind of just stop touring, didn't they? Which sort of probably prolonged their career for a few more years.
Sure.
And you know, and Oasis didn't do that. And I think that that's the difference. Is, you know, these days you haven't got kind of that. You know, if you're in a band and you want to make money, now you have to tour. The revenue streams just aren't there anymore from recordings. So, you know, and it was, you know, it's funny when they did split up, Noel's statement said something along the lines of, "It is with great sadness but immense relief that I leave today. I could not stand working with Liam one day more," or something like that.
And what is that great closing line he had about, you know, "I'll put on my cap and..." It's wonderful. "And head out to pasture," or something. It's a wonderful closing line.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, it's basically, you know, "I'm exiting the stage now."
Oh, right. Yeah. Yes, it was. I know what you mean. I just can't pull it. But yeah, it's one of those now that, you know, Noel has now had the spotlight for a number of years. He's now revered. After in that 2000s when, you know, Oasis, you know, the value dropped quite significantly, and those sort of three 2000s albums were, you know, quite, you know, were received, and they sold well, but it wasn't anything, you know, they were no longer relevant, they were no longer the band, you know, the likes of Arctic Monkeys and Coldplay and things definitely usurped them and became the biggest. Whereas now with Noel, he's sort of taken on kind of more of an elder statesman of rock kind of persona. And is, you know, is very active. He's often on Russell Brand's radio shows. He's often on the TV shows, and he's much more of that sort of TV, you know, aging rock star personality now. Whereas Liam is still just Liam. He's still, I mean, he's probably the person on Twitter that I go onto Twitter just to check if he's tweeted, because he just comes out with this the craziest stuff. And
he's like Trump, right? I mean, you just sort of check to see what he says. I know what you mean. Yeah,
because he's so he is like Trump in that way. Yeah.
Now, when you, I want to turn the question back on you. So, how do we think about, you know, when you read about him, it's so simplistic to say he has erratic behavior traits, right? You know, the unpredictable erratic. Is that too simplistic to try to think of him that way? Because I tend to side with the elder statesman songwriter guy, and I tend to connect with him. Can you hold for one quick second?
Go for it.
We can edit this, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Try not to laugh too much, but the reason why I had to go to the door is I saw the Federal Express guy delivering what I know this is.
What is it? It's not Sergeant Pepper.
It is Sergeant Pepper, my advance copy sent from Apple. So it could not have come at a better, weirder time. Anyway, so I did not want... I thought he was going to make me sign for it, but you know how it is. They often just leave things laying on your doorstep. I've lost many a package
that way.
Some
people leave laying on your doorstep. That's another. That's a good. What's the release date? It's 24th, I think.
It's the 26th, but it's my advanced review copy that they sent me.
Goodness me! So.
Anyway, so let's definitely continue. But my question again, I'll say it again. So
I thought you were just leaving then. So forget this. I'm going to go and listen to Sergeant Pepper.
That's right. The phone call's over. Let's continue with my question. I think it's one I'd love to hear your answer on. So,
okay.
He's described as erratic and unpredictable. And of course, as you said before, his tweets prove it out. His behavior, particularly in the first decade of this new century, he was the story. It's been made fun of in Claymation, as I know you know.
Rock and roll is nothing highbrow, even if you got a bushy eyebrow. It's all down a presentation and a strange pronunciation. The melodies still shine, even through the nasal whine. Though the music's good when we begin it, soon you're saying, hey, wait a minute. Haven't you heard this song before? Isn't the tune a tad familiar? Sounds bloody close to something else.
Goo-goo-goo-choo.
Haven't we seen this band before? Blocks with guitars and a drummer. Frankly, it's nothing new at all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like the Who, we have a punch up. Like the Sex Pistols, throw our lunch up. Like the Kinks, we're strappy brothers. Do the drugs like all the others. Every band is shags and bimbos. Throw tennis out a hotel window. It's old hat and that's no fun. We shoot ourselves, but even that's been done. Haven't you heard this song before? Jesus, it's hard to be original with only 12 notes in all the world.
In perfect harmony.
Haven't you seen it all before? All of the films and books and TV, everyone sounds like someone else.
And I
else.
Don't know why.
Haven't you heard this song before?
Love, love, love.
Haven't you heard this song before? Hey, that's new. Haven't heard that before.
Yeah, you know, Saturday Night Live has made fun of the brothers. Mm-hmm. Is he really that erratic, or is there something more there that would help us understand him?
Well, a lot of it is played up for the cameras. So those and what's been quite good doing this is that we are getting stories from people that have met him and the general consensus is, if you just go and if you just meet him in the pub or you meet him in the street, he's a lovely guy, and he will take the time to speak to you, and he'll, you know, shake your hand, and he'll listen, and he has a lot of time for people, you know. So, but yeah, when it's the cameras are on, it's time. It's his showtime, you know, and he wants to, and he's going to play up to it, and it's also. I think it comes from the background. It comes from the... It's a very... All right. Don't show off then. I know what you... This is breaking my heart. Look at that. Listeners, Ken has just got out this... Oh, goodness me. What is it? The 5 vinyl set?
No, this should be the 6-disc multi thing, I guess. I don't know. So,
all right.
Yeah, but
yeah. So I think it comes from the background, because if you take it back to that, you've got very working class guys. Liam's not educated at all. Dropped out of school very early. Had no kind of no formal education. No, you know, difficult family background. But also the youngest of three boys, so very spoiled. You know, spoiled because he was, you know, obviously a beautiful man as well. So always. Was a spoilt little boy who got his own way, very handsome, you know, and so his older brothers probably would have had to do everything around the house, whereas the little golden boy Liam could do whatever he wanted.
That's right.
And then he grows up as well with this sort of real arrogant streak as well of just being from Manchester and being a kind of a bit of a lad as well, and just a scally. Never had any kind of interest or inclination to make music at all. Really, until there's the film Supersonic, in which they tell the story that he actually got whacked in the head with a hammer, and then he sort of woke up from being whacked in the head with a hammer, and suddenly could sing and was interested in music, which I think is a bit of an apocryphal tale. But I think it's then seeing the Stone Roses come through in Manchester. You know, being the Stone Roses being this coolest band, you know, with just this swagger and attitude and just very quiet. Almost menacing, aloof attitude. And Liam picks up on that. And you can see in the early interviews, he's very much copying that sort of style, that kind of aloof, too cool for school, you know, almost a little bit similar to Lennon, in that Lennon would have that kind of sarcastic way of answering questions in quite an aggressive way. And so you think, well, is he being... is he being genuine, or is he, you know, what's he doing, what's he saying there? But it is just that sort of, it's a very much a British thing, but it's very much a Northern thing as well, in that everything's kind of a joke, everything's antagonism. Is it how genuine is it, or is it, you know, all just a bit of a laugh? So that's just inherent in him. And then you add that to getting extremely successful at 21 years of age, and so straight away he's just had, you know, all told, money and drugs and everything he could ever want from such a young age, combined with everything in there. So yeah, you do just end up with this sort of erratic behavior. But ultimately now he's a father, and by all accounts, I think he does the school run in the morning, and he does his job, you know, he cooks food, and, you know, he lives a life. He's not going out and being like a Shane McGowan from the Pogues or a Keith, you know, Keith Richards or something, just partying all every day, even though he's in his 40s now. You know, I think he lives the normal life. It's just you put a microphone in front of him or a camera in front of him, and he'll say something stupid or aggressive or you know, to deliberately to play up to it.
You have to figure, I do, that they have a second or third act out there. I really do believe that. I mean, that the great tragedy, one of the many tragedies of John Lennon being murdered, but a personal one for him, is he never gets to be 41. He never gets to be 45 or 50 and look back and say, wow, I wish I didn't say that thing. You know, and you know, he would have. He would have. I think he would have been like Paul, the way McCartney has sort of come to the place where he's okay that people want to read Let It Be as a song about religiosity, right? And even Catholicism for some listeners. He's okay with that, even though that wasn't his intention. I think John would have, one of the songs he poo-pooed during his last months on Earth was 8 days a week. You know, and maybe he doesn't love 8 days a week. I bet 8 days a week didn't feel very cool just as he turned 40 and he's trying to create a new career for himself. But I bet you years later, when he turned 50 or 60, he would have said, you know what, maybe I don't like 8 days a week, but a lot of people are pleased by it.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the place that the Gallagher brothers have left out there for them, simply because they're not dead and there's still, they have plenty of years ahead of them.
Well, I mean, Liam would reform with Oasis tomorrow. You know,
absolutely.
He said that constantly. You know, he's his favorite band in the world is Oasis, and he wants to be in Oasis. I mean, he formed BDI, which was basically Oasis without Noel, when Noel left. So they rebranded as BDI, which was, you know, a good thing to do, because they could have carried on as Oasis just without Noel, but obviously it wouldn't have been Oasis.
I thought it was a smart move. Yeah.
Yeah, and then but then now what's happened is that Noel is now, you know, well established as a solo artist in his own right. Liam always said he wouldn't go solo, just because he believes in being in a band. But he is now going solo. You know, it's been announced he's doing a solo album, solo tour. So he's currently putting a band together to back him up. But he's going out under the name Liam Gallagher now, rather than being under BDI or whatever other name. So yeah, it's going to be interesting. Yeah, we'll have to see what happens in the next, you know, with this big tour he's got coming up, with the album that will come out later this year. And yeah, I mean, I think I ran the poll, you know, do we think Oasis should get back together again or not? And I think it came out about yes, sort of 60% and no, 40%. I think there's a lot of people that think they shouldn't, or if they do, it should just be for live. You know, just maybe almost like Pink Floyd did. You know, they did that one last sort of Live 8 or whatever, and they might, you know, or like Led Zepp did with that one-off gig.
Sure.
I mean, they might come back and do sort of a tour, but it's one of the things that one of the guys said in one of our recent episodes is he would hate the idea of them reforming if Noel doesn't want to do it. So if Noel sat there at the side of the stage sort of gritting his teeth and just going through the motions, we don't want to see that. You know, we want to see, as fans of Noel Gallagher, we want to see Noel, you know, doing it if he really wants to do it. And I think for them, they need to repair their relationship first. You know, they need to somehow managed to, well, Liam just needs to stop being so aggressive and rude to his brother. And then once they've kind of figured that out and they can actually be in the same room together, then they could do live things. Because other than that, they don't need the money. Noel doesn't need the money anyway. As the songwriter, obviously, he's earned a lot more. So he definitely doesn't need the money.
Right. And, you know, and they would need to recognize, too, that if they do reform, they're not the same Oasis. They can use the name and should use the name, but they'll be a different band, you know, and that's okay. I mean, if the there were always those dreams of the Beatles reunion. And Paul said a few years after Lennon's murder, he said, you know, we could have and probably would have done that. But it wouldn't have been the same group. You have to recognize that once you stop the chemistry for a certain amount of time, you return as different selves. And that's just how creative artistry works, right?
It's never the same.
Yeah, it's not. And that's okay. But embrace the difference and be that band.
Yeah.
As Fleetwood Mac has done, what, 40 times.
Yes. Yeah. One of the Something About the Beatles episodes they did was where they did if the Beatles had toured, if John had survived and the Beatles had got back together in the 80s, what would they have played? What would they have sounded like? Like it's sort of a fantasy concert sort of thing. And they did a mock-up picture of, you know, what they would have looked like in the 80s together on stage. And actually looking at that, I went, oh no, I wouldn't have wanted that actually. You know, I wouldn't like, or even if you think if they got back together in like 78, you know, with Paul with his like mullet and with, you know, I just think, no, I just think it's so perfect that they had these, they had that 7 years that coincided with all this change of the 60s. And if they had come back and done stuff in the 70s, I would have liked to, you know, if I could change history, I would have said they carried on recording together throughout the 70s. Because, you know, for me, like what, you know, I like a lot of John's solo stuff and Paul's and George's, but I think that what they're all missing is each other's input, you know, and you just think, what would John have brought to Ram, or what would, you know, Paul have bought to, you know, Mind Games. You know, if he, like all those, it that's really sad to me.
And every one of those records would have been better.
Yes, oh, absolutely.
Without question, because what they always missed, even on the last albums they made through December 1980, was each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, speaking of albums, and one of the things that makes that drives the Beatles story so well is that they have these masterworks, right? Rubber Soul, Revolver, Sgt. Pepper, the White Album, Abbey Road, even the Let It Be Get Back project, right? It has some monumental moments. So one thing that I think would help Oasis is if their readership and listenership started to think of them in terms of their best moments. I mean, What's the Story? Morning Glory, for example, is a tremendous album. You know, and to start thinking of them, because this is a band that very, open-facedly based their existence on the Beatles, and in fact, really perfect the sound that the Beatles were driving towards.
Yeah.
William, what's the staple of the 1970s? Radio, it's While My Guitar Gently Weeps and songs like that. I mean, they are the hardest driving moments of the White Album, right? I mean, they really are. Oasis perfect that sound. So, you know, although they have wonderful acoustic moments too. But, you know, one thing that might help is for Oasis to do to have their own marketing moment and market those great great album length moments.
I mean, they have done reissues. So the last sort of, as it's been 20 years, you know, they have now reissued sort of those albums, which has been, you know, it's the same thing. They sort of packaged them up and put them out in these nice sets and things. And they had the Supersonic film, but once again, you know, they're not coming together to do it. So, you know, the Supersonic film, Noel didn't turn up at the premiere and Liam did, and just things like that. So it's a shame. And there was, I think the closest it came was, I thought that there was a chance for them to do a 20th anniversary of What's the Story. I thought that maybe if there was some, if they could have been arranged, I think that would have made sense to come back and do, because a lot of the Britpop bands are coming back and doing, you know, 20th anniversary of this album. You know, like Ocean Colour Scene did it for Mosley Shoals and various other groups have done it. They've gone out and played that album in its entirety. And I think that that would have made sense for Morning Glory. But, you know, I think you always, you have these ones where they end up in, well, I'm in this period now. It's like boxers, you know, when you're waiting for two boxers to fight each other, but, oh no, I've got to make this defence and I've got to make this defence. And then so they just, the schedules don't line up. And that's how it's been with albums. It's like, all right, well, they can't do anything for a while because Noel's touring this album and then Liam's going to do this. And so you're just waiting for them to both sort of finish the current projects. Is it going to happen? But no, because they still hate each other. So
right, and that may never change, unfortunately. But I would think elevating those masterworks would be really smart, so that people can spend more extended time thinking about the music and what they achieved, as opposed to, I remember when it was happening, as do you, and of course, it was all about, you know, remember the interviews on MTV and VH1 where they would have subtitles. At a certain point, all of that to me got rather silly, you know, as though they were unintelligible completely. And of course, a few times they were, but but you know what I'm saying. The story became more about them for a while and what outrageous thing would happen next, as opposed to, damn, this album's great.
Yes. And I mean, and like, it's part of the reason for doing this is that, you know, there just isn't that same level of recognition for those works. And you know, you go on and you can find isolated tracks, but, you know, people haven't been doing it to the extent that they do it for, you know, the likes of the Beatles. And that's what, you know, even sort of pulling out and thinking, okay, well, let's look at, I did the episode where with a drummer and sort of said, okay, let's compare the different drummers that Oasis had over the years, because they got through a few, almost Spinal Tap levels. And, you know, and it just hasn't, you know, just doing internet searches and things, you just like, oh, this hasn't been done. There's nothing out there, really. There's like forum posts. You know, there's a good forum, Live Forever forums, is really good. And there's like a Reddit about Oasis that's very good. But it's only just people getting their stuff down. This isn't sort of the esteemed, this is what the scholars feel or whatever. It's just the general consensus from the public of what people think. And so, you know, so my last episode that I'm just editing and getting out now is sort of is going through the chronicle of them live, you know, and sort of explaining, okay, well, these were the different phases of their live show, you know, from when they first start out and it's just five piece, pretty much playing just the first set of songs, and then and they introduce Noel sitting down and doing an acoustic set, and then it changes again and it changes again. And so it did change over the years, but there's no book about that. There's no kind of text about it. I'm just kind of making it up from what I know and from what I've read, and it's sort of, it's just strange. It's just strange that it hasn't had that level, because, let's say, in 1996, 97, if you went into like a bookshop or record shop, there were stacks of books about Oasis, but there's been nothing that's actually chronicled their career. You know, there's been nothing that's sort of followed them all the way through to sort of 2008.
Okay, well then I'll say it because I know it's on your listeners' mind. Why are you not writing that book?
Because I never learned to read and write. That's why I do a podcast. That's why podcasters do it.
But okay, I have a feeling you're literate, so... and you don't have to. You don't have to read Virginia Woolf to be able to write that book. Look, there are 3,000 books on the Beatles,
3,000,
something like that, right? I mean, it's the latest number I've heard, and most of them probably don't have a need for space on the bookshelf. I may have even been the cause of some of that at some point or another. but the point I'm trying to make is. My most recent interest when I decided to write the George Martin biography, for example, or the Beatles Encyclopedia, yes. I did that because those are the books I wish I had on my shelf.
Yes.
Right? So what book do you wish you had on your shelf? You want the career retrospective from a certain point,
yeah.
from beginning to end.
I want Revolution in the Head of Oasis.
Sure, or maybe Revolution in the Head. Why don't you write that book? But have a better ending than poor Ian McDonald, wonderful as he was.
And so, very unfortunately, that was the end of that. We did carry on talking for about another 20 minutes, but something Ken's end went a bit wrong. And so when he sent me the audio, it just cuts out at that point. So I've still got about 20 minutes of me just talking to myself and going, which I could throw up. It wouldn't be particularly interesting, so I'm not going to. But anyway, just to finish off this discussion on the Beatles and Oasis, because I don't think we covered a lot of what I really wanted to in that interview. I mean, we'll come back to it. It's obviously a topic that's really, really important and is worth looking at. So just to follow up on the polls. So I did a poll... who is the best songwriter out of John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, Noel Gallagher? In the end, John Lennon took it 39%, Paul 31%, Noel 19%, and George 11%. And we got loads and loads of really good and interesting responses on that. So thank you very much for everyone who took part. So let's have Noel covering a John Lennon song. So the next poll we did was best songwriter from Division 2. So if we're assuming those four out of the all the people that have made up Oasis and the Beatles were the best four, then who's the next best? So the next best four I've gone with as Ringo Starr, Liam Gallagher, Andy Bell and Gem. And first, Liam went into the lead. Liam was going to win this. And then a Ride fan page... and saw what was happening, and then loads of Ride fans came in and voted. So Andy Bell ended up taking it. So the final result there was Andy Bell at 43, Liam Gallagher at 35, Gem at 12, and Ringo at 10. So poor old Ringo, you know, Don't Pass Me By, obviously a undiscovered classic at this point. So, well, I suppose we'll have an Andy Bell song. So as we said with the conversation with Ken, I ran the poll on Twitter to say what is the best Oasis cover of a Beatles song, and yeah, I'm the Walrus took it quite comfortably. But what is the best version of I'm the Walrus? So I ran that as a poll, and the options were the Oasis B-side version, the live one, Oasis on the There and Then video from Earl's Court with the bootleg Beatles in the background, the Beatles version from Magical Mystery Tour, or Lasagna, which is something I occasionally throw into polls. And yeah, Lasagna got 6%, so thank you for all the legends that chose that. The Oasis B-side version got 24%, and the Beatles and the Oasis There and Then version got 35% each. It was actually a tie. So because the Oasis B-side and the Oasis There and Then combined got more than the Beatles, I think that is confirmation, proof that Oasis are actually better than the Beatles. So I'm pleased we've got that sorted finally. So yeah, isn't that good? So I think we'll end this show today with a bit of a mashup of the various versions of I'm the Walrus. So thank you very much for listening. Just to reiterate the competition again, please drop me a tweet at Oasis Podcast with who is the best dressed man in rock and roll or in music and your reason why. Best one I will pick, and it will win a Supernova scarf. And so make sure you're following Supernova Scarves, and I say check them out. They've got a fantastic range of very cool stuff. And just a reminder of the Oasis night that's coming up on the 17th of June, Saturday the 17th of June. Follow our friends at What's the Story 3 on Twitter, Ant and Tell, who I did the last episode with. If you can get down to Northampton, 17th of June, Oasis night at the Charles Bradlaugh, do it. I'm going to be there with a bunch of my friends from home, and yeah, and Ant and the guys are going to be there. So come along, have a drink. Dance around like you're 17 again to Oasis. It's going to be brilliant. So here we go. Thanks very much for listening, and we've got some great episodes coming up, but for now, here's I'm the Walrus. Thank you.
Semolina filtered, blooming up the Eiffel Tower. That's it. I'm passionate about rock and roll.
And you've never denied that the huge influence that the Beatles have had on you. And you like to maintain that feeling about your music.
Yeah, I love the Beatles, you know. What can I say? I'm not going to hide it. I love them. They make me happy. They make me, you know. And I think they're the best and still are. And I think to learn, if you're going to be as good, you've got to learn from the best, and they're the best.
Yeah, it's Lennon rather than McCartney, though. His edge, if you
but
like.
But it's his voice. I like his voice. He's got a good voice.
Yeah, and the attack.
Yeah, and there's a bit of pain in there. You know what I mean? You know the guy's done a day's work, as they say.